Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
On today's show, the propagandist who outwitted Hitler, with Peter Pomerantsev and his new book, How to Win an Information War.
Peter Pomerantsev is a senior fellow at Johns Hopkins University, where he studies contemporary propaganda and how to defeat it. His first book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, won the 2016 RSL Ondaatje Prize and was nominated for the Guardian First Book Award, the Pushkin Prize, the Bailey Gifford Prize and the Gordon Byrne Prize. His second book, This is Not Propaganda, won the 2020 Gordon Byrne Prize. His essay on authoritarian propaganda, Memory in the Age of Impunity, won the 2022 European Press Prize, and he's also a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. And today we're here to talk about Peter's latest book, which is How to Win an Information War, The Propagandist Who Outwitted Hitler. Peter, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for introducing me. That was very nice. Thank you.
So this propagandist who outwitted Hitler is a man called Sefton Delmer, who the book is about. So tell us, first of all, when you first came across him.
Oh, God, it was so long ago. I think somewhere during sort of 2014, during the initial Russian invasion of Ukraine. And I remember being at a sort of a brainstorm with all sorts of journalists and academics and officials. And somebody said, has anybody here heard of Sefton Delmer? And made the case that we should be doing psyops of our own against Russia, to which everybody in the room kind of reacted in a predictably sort of snotty way, and probably quite rightly. Everybody in the room was talking about the need for transparency and fact-checking and quality journalism in order to enlighten people about the disinformation and hate being spewed by Russian state media and troll farms. But I was kind of intrigued by who this guy Sefton Delmer was. And I began researching him largely, you know, with the assumption that what could I learn as a student of disinformation about our own use of it in World War II? You know, what insights could I glean about what Russia or the far right are up to from what we did, for good or ill, in World War II? But as I started exploring him, I basically had this sort of wow moment when I was reading his out-of-print memoirs. And basically, from 1943 onwards, Delmer, who ran this sort of network of covert radio stations, which were British but claimed to be Nazi, actually wanted his audience to understand it was the British masquerading as the Nazis. And the audience understood that the British wanted them to understand it was the British masquerading as the Nazis. And what he was actually doing was creating cover for his audiences. He wanted to give them a safe space within which to express their resentment to the Nazis, within which to be disloyal to their own country, and through which to do what they want. He had a theory of communication that propaganda is about enabling what you really want to do anyway, not about persuasion. So suddenly I realized that this is actually a very, very, very sophisticated operation that on the surface looked like any old covert bit of propaganda where you sort of essentially create the sock puppet media, which was very, very standard in war, actually. And actually was something much, much more interesting.
So why do you think none of those people had heard of him? Why is he so forgotten? And obviously the work he was doing was secret and then remained secret, as is the way after the war. But when one thinks now of how famous someone like Alan Turing is, why is Sefton Delma forgotten, do you think?
So he wasn't forgotten in his own time. He was a superstar reporter, you know, when apart from his, you know, outside of his work for the political warfare executive in World War II, he was a sort of like a mix of Tintin and Borat. He was this incredible roving foreign affairs reporter with a gift for impersonation. He'd often dress up as different characters in order to sort of like investigate something. He sort of impersonated Ernst Röhm, the head of the stormtroopers, as assistant to get into a stormtrooper rally and many other instances. So he was this incredibly prolific, probably the most famous British foreign correspondent of his time, or one of. And after the war, and after he retired, he was on radio and TV. There was a This Is Your Life about him. His memoirs came out in the 60s. So he was actually very well known in the sort of 50s and 60s. And he told the story of his own operations. But you're right, that sort of 70s, 80s, 90s, he gets forgotten, 2000s. And his son speculated that the reason he was forgotten was that, you know, a lot of what he did was amoral and naughty. And in his own memoirs, Delmore sort of positions himself in what is what he calls a baddie baddie, you know, doing the naughty work in the war, sort of the tricks and various pieces of subterfuge to subvert the Nazis. And his son speculated that nobody really wanted to think about that side of the war. We sort of heroized the war as our finest hour. And nobody wanted to think about this sort of thing. I think it's high time we did. First, because I think Delmer is a much, much, much more complicated, both a much more complicated character, but I'm also a much more complicated practitioner of both propaganda and counter-propaganda that can seem when one first discovers him. And also, you know, the insights that he had about the power of authoritarian propaganda and what you can do about it and what doesn't work and what does work seems very, very relevant today when we're all sort of wondering how the hell we sort of communicate with people in dictatorships who seem to be enjoying or at least acquiescing to authoritarian propaganda, or people in democracies who seem to be in their own echo chamber of alternative facts. Delmer was interested in propaganda throughout the 20th century. He didn't see the Nazis as a sort of, to put it differently, he saw Nazi propaganda as part of a pattern that he'd observed in Germany in World War One and Britain in World War One and post-war Germany. So obviously the Nazis belong in a special realm of nastiness, but Delmer also saw patterns and the emergence of authoritarian propaganda in his own time.
It's sort of interesting that when we think of propaganda sort of commonly, it tends to be thought of as something the bad guys do.
Well, I mean, look, I mean, yes, usually, well, all that we do, but is entirely negative. I mean, so Delmer never really defines what he means by propaganda. He has no problem calling himself a propagandist. You know, if we're going to get into the academic definitions of it, which I do in the book is sort of part Ben McIntyre, part Marshall McLuhan. I mean, there's sort of a World War II yarn in the middle of it. And then I sort of do these escapades into the present, comparing the challenges we face today, but also there's quite a lot in the book about what is propaganda and how do we define it. But, you know, there's a way of defining it, which is more neutral in the sense that any type of mass persuasion, a neutral word with a bad reputation, I think is how one person described it. And we can get into why it has a bad reputation. One clever interpretation of why it has a bad reputation is that it comes from the Catholic, a papal decree in the sort of early Renaissance, De Propaganda Fide, to spread the faith. And there's one interpretation that says that in Protestant countries like England, the word propaganda is negative because it's associated with the Catholic Church. Very interesting that in Eastern European cultures, it's not taken as a positive or negative. It just is an activity. These things are very culturally fluid. But there's a neutral way of looking at it. And then there's like a more subtle interpretations. Someone I look at in the book is Jacques Ellul, who's a French sort of thinker who wrote a great one-volume book called Propaganda, where he talks about propaganda as a product of the kind of loneliness and atomization that people experience in industrial societies. And propaganda is how we make up for loneliness. Propaganda is the remedy for loneliness. So when people are thrust out of the world they once knew, propaganda is that which substitutes community. And I think today, like we saw in COVID or something, you know, this boost and growth and online conspiracy theories and stuff during COVID. So you know, to make up for our loneliness. So in that sense, you know, someone in Lul would say it's probably a thing with many negatives because it stifles critical thinking. but it's something which is a kind of an almost inevitable product of a certain type of industrial society. So we can go on and on about trying to define it. But Delmer was, if we talk about what he was doing, his aim was to undermine the connection and the link and the hold that the Nazis had over their army, over their population, to kind of tear the emotional bond between the two. And I think it's really quite remarkable the things he did to try and do that.
You mentioned how close he got to Ernst Bohm, and there's a scene in the book where, I mean, he travels with Hitler on one of his speaking tours, and the first time he meets him is at a place called the Brown House, Hitler's house. So tell us what Delmer thought of these early meetings with the Nazis.
So the first time he sees Hitler, he kind of dismisses him as a crank. So Berlin at the time is full of what he calls miracle men, who are people kind of spouting, a bit like Alex Jones today, a mix of how to make Germany great again and selling sort of like, you know, magic pills that will make you strong. It's very interesting how the same things repeat today's warp century as well. So he completely dismisses him the first time he sees him. He's some crank pushing some bizarre theories about racial purity and insisting that Germans should stop eating oranges because oranges are foreign. And then very quickly, the Nazis start to win seats in the parliament, and Delmer decides to explore them again. And he really describes them as a cabaret at first, literally. In one of his early encounters with them, he says, oh, look, he literally describes them as a cabaret act in a city that's full of cabaret acts. This is sort of the cabaret age in Berlin. And I think Delmer's great sort of insight was that what propaganda gives people are roles to perform in a chaotic time. And the Nazis, like others, their theories are absurd. And even the roles they give people are sort of almost grotesquely comedic. But they're coherent in a time of confusion. And their roles through which legitimize people's desire for cruelty and sadism and submission. So he sees the essence of propaganda about giving people roles. And he sees us all as performing different roles in society and on the stage of life. And the successful propagandist offers people these fulfilling roles. And the only way to really fight that is to undermine people's enjoyment of those roles and develop better ones for them. So I don't think Delmer ever thinks you're ever your true self. I don't think he ever thinks we ever stop performing in some way. But I think what he tried to do in his propaganda, counter-propaganda, was give people an opportunity to play other roles. So he talks about Hitler. He gets to fly with Hitler during Hitler's very famous flight around hysterical Nazi rallies at the 28 election. And he's in the plane with Hitler as Hitler goes from rally to rally and describes in wonderful detail about how much of an actor Hitler is, how he transforms from the sort of bored, blank-faced traveling salesman into the great Führer light god through a series of acts, really. But what's interesting is that he says the crowds are kind of performing as well, which I think the only other person who wrote about that was, that I know, is Adorno. But they come to the same conclusion that these hysterical crowds are kind of performing their hysteria, that this too is a sort of act. And when I first read it, both in Adorno and Delmer, I wondered what they meant, because we always associate Nazi rallies with people in an almost hypnotic state. But I think the closest I managed to sort of get to it in my head is going raving in my misspent youth, where you were also meant to be in a trance. Literally, the music was called trance. And yet, you were performing that trance. You know, it was, a bit of you was always completely rational. It was sort of, you're acting that trance. And I think Delmer will say the same thing, that people are always ever so slightly performing. And your job is to sort of unpick that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Peter Pomerantsev, and we're talking about his new book, How to Win an Information War, The Propagandist Who Outwitted Hitler. And Peter, it occurs to me we've never really talked about why Sefton Delmar was uniquely the person to be in the position of both being a propagandist, but also as a journalist, being incredibly close to the Nazis. Tell us something about his early life.
Yeah, so he was the son of an Australian-British academic at Berlin University. He was born in Berlin, and he was 10 years old when World War One started, and the family got trapped in Berlin. So he got bullied at school for being British. And they get to Britain in 1917, he's bullied for being too German. He's always very aware of his own status as an insider-outsider. And I think that's actually where his sort of sense that all social roles are performed comes from, because he sort of he talks about how he learns to become this sort of perfect English schoolboy later, but also how before that he already thought he was English and was sort of playing the English boy in his German school. And then he gets to England and they're like, you're not English. So he's very aware how these things are learnt, played, but also there's no kind of you outside of them either. You know, you are the things that you play, but you can play different things. So I think that's sort of the great experience of his youth. And he never gets over it. He writes about how he never feels British enough. Maybe that's part of the reason he goes back to Germany after university, because there he can be English, weirdly. So when he goes to Germany, that he can be English, because he gets to define what being English means. And he's sort of suddenly Sefton Delmar of the Express, rather than some weird, you know, hybrid. So I think those young youthful experiences really, really influenced his views on life.
So you mentioned in the first half Delmar's idea of what propaganda should be and what it could do, and certainly what it could do for the war effort. Obviously, on the other side, Germany famously, through Dr. Joseph Goebbels, is using propaganda. So what are the Germans doing at this point?
Well, there's the domestic propaganda, which once they get into power, grows from rallies to dominate all forms of media, but especially radio. One of the things the Germans do is build what they call the Volksempfänger. These are kind of cheap radios. They're like, you know, they built the Volkswagens to make sure everyone had cars. And this is the radio equivalent. And Germany becomes the highest per capita owning population of radios in Europe. And that's kind of revolutionary, because suddenly Hitler isn't just at a rally. Hitler's inside your living room. And there's a lot of writing at the time about how radio's broken down the borders between the public and the private. Suddenly, the outside world is in your front room. The radio is Hitler speeches, and Hitler speeches are very, very special occasions. When he gives a speech, you're meant to stop working. Wardens come round to make sure everybody's listening to their radios or loudspeaker. And the cities sort of go silent as everyone listens to the Führer. But it was much more than that. They essentially, I mean, it's very similar to what cable news or Russian state media do today. They essentially created this incredible drama where all the news was part of a drama on the radio. You know, it was a conspiratorial drama where brave Hitlerjugend and Hitler were always fighting the sort of the deep state and the Jewish newspapers and you know, the global conspiracy against Germany. Right, sort of every event was framed within, you know, every news was framed within this tension, which was very, very dramatic and took messy complexity and put it into a drama of darkness and light. But then they did a lot of other innovations.
When the war starts, they have something called the Front Report, which is incredibly popular, which is basically embedded journalists. You know, this sort of, you know, introduces concepts of embedded journalists who are literally, you know, with the front tanks as they pour into Poland, or in the cockpit with a Luftwaffe pilot as he bombs London, giving these incredibly, incredibly sort of interactive reports of a weirdly bloodless war. You've got to remember that, you know, Germans were, like the British, very traumatized by World War One. Nobody wanted to think about loss. So these incredibly dramatic reality show, like blitzkrieg wars that the Germans were waging as they conquered most of Europe. And these reports played down casualties and played up heroic survival and just made people feel as if they're part of this incredible game. At the same time, they're like, you know, getting people, you know, the Nazis are getting people to take part, to be part of the Nazi show, the Nazi spectacle. That means taking part in marches, taking part in communal dinners. You know, they want to bring everybody into this huge spectacle that they were creating. And they actually pioneered some things which were kind of early versions of social media. So people started owning cameras en masse, and the Nazis encouraged people to essentially take photographs of themselves doing Nazi activities and sending it into newspapers, so kind of selfies. And then sort of soldiers get given cameras, and they get given these special diaries where they're meant to write their diaries, and there's special spaces for photographs of themselves, like by the Eiffel Tower. And they're meant to sort of fill these in and send them back to their relatives. So again, so much like your Facebook page. So they were very consciously integrating people into their huge cabaret, making everybody a co-player, not just a passive observer. But at the end of the day, you were meant to have given up your individuality to the Nazis. That was their philosophy. The era of individualism is over, Goebbels would say. We're now part of one folk. You know, in the great rallies, you were meant to enter a hypnotic state. I mean, that was very much the idea, that you would give up your, you know, your fragile, puny individual self and melt into the orgiastic mass of the folk, where even as a, you know, when you're doing your individuality is, you know, you're kind of one limb in a great synchronized act of fascism. So that's what they were pushing for. At the same time, they're doing lots of propaganda directed at Britain. I mean, we all know about Lord Haw Haw, who was this Irish-American acting as if he was English, who would sort of broadcast overtly, say, look, I am a Nazi radio guy, and I'm telling you, you're about to lose, give up. But the more interesting stuff they did was create all these stations that pretended to be British stations. There was a station called the Workers' Challenge with a bunch of Cockneys. They're all POWs, basically, claiming that they were kind of like in the East End under bombardment and the Blitz, and sort of spreading conspiracy theories that British factory bosses were not telling their workers about, you know, impending bombardment, so the workers would work longer and produce more for the bosses. And this radio station would call British workers to rise up and rebel. There was another station aimed at Scottish nationalists, saying, why should Scotland be part of England's war? Others are Christians, saying all Christians should be pacifists, and so on and so forth. They were quite successful at first, these stations, but they were so obviously hammy and so obviously reflecting Nazi worldviews. I mean, they were obsessed with Jews, constantly talking about like how the Jews control Churchill. That even if they got quite a lot of attention at the start when they first launched, but then kind of people quickly, A, realized it was the Germans behind them, and B, weren't really convinced by their agenda.
So Sefton Delmer ends up via a sort of circuitous route in the PWA, the political war executive, in various clandestine meetings in private members' clubs and a few bumps where clearly his sympathies are sort of suspected. There are doubts over where his sympathies lie because of his background and what have you. Yeah, you see this in his MI5 file much later on. But he finally ends up at Woburn Abbey, which is the site of where all this work is going on during the war. And his first major creation is De Scheff. So tell us who De Scheff was and what they did with him.
So De Scheff was the first covert station that Delmer created. And it's his most famous one, even though really was nothing as others were much more important. But this one was kind of the most obviously fun one. Essentially, Delmer comes in and says, look, I don't believe in what the BBC are doing. The BBC German service preached the converted. They just talk, it's liberals talking to liberals about democracy, and no one cares about that in Germany anymore. And he doesn't want to do anything romantic. There's another station, the British sponsor, which is full of something called the Zender der Europäischen Revolution, which is exhorting Germans to rise up and have a socialist revolution. And Dalma's like, the moment for this has passed. It's too late now. And he creates this character called Der Chef, who is a rabid, right-wing, racist, porn-spewing, invective, vomiting senior officer who likes Hitler, but thinks Nazi officials are all corrupt and secret Bolsheviks, who kind of appeals to from a position even further right than the Nazis in some way, certainly on the military side. And he plays into this idea that, you know, there's a split between the army and the party. And he does these sort of foul-mouthed diatribes about the corruption of mid-level Nazi officials, about their orgies, with a lot of detail. I mean, there's quite spectacular porn scenes, basically. And but with an incredible amount of actual research and detail about actual corruption. He did use disinformation, but most of his efforts were about veracity. And he went to extraordinary lengths to find out sort of the details of the lives of these mid-level ranking Nazi officials through interviewing POWs, through reports from partisans, opening up letters that Nazi officials sent to relatives in America, and so on and so forth. And that's what made the chef so remarkable. And very quickly, he becomes very popular. We have some sources in Germany saying he's the most listened to station in Germany. I assume they mean the most listened to underground station. He's broadcasting on shortwave. But he kind of broke through a taboo. He starts broadcasting in mid-41, which is when Nazi power is at its zenith. People are either in love with the Nazis or in total fear of them. There's no kind of cracks in the edifice yet. And people like Erich Kästner, the great writer, you know, he's still in Germany, despite being against the Nazis, sort of writing this diaries about this incredible station. Nobody knows who's broadcasting it. Where is it being broadcast from? This soldier is breaking all these taboos, about breaking taboos, breaking what people in communications, academia call the spiral of silence, saying the unsayable, but also very much developing this idea that there is a split between the army and the party. But Delma's aim is not sort of start a movement with this guy. He doesn't want to start a far-right rebellion or something. He wants normal people to listen to the station. And as they listen to it, they don't have to agree with this guy's philosophy at all. They're not meant to, actually. They're just meant to get a sense like, oh my God, there's cracks between the Nazi party and the army. And somebody must be giving this guy cover to be saying these things. So there must be some sort of conspiracy afoot. So sort of, you know, lower the level of fear that people had of the Nazis. But also very subtly to kind of change behaviors. So the Der Chef is constantly ranting about corruption. His aim isn't to stop corruption. You know, the idea was by talking about corruption, people would be more corrupt themselves and thus undermine the Nazi economy. Or talking about how soldiers were defecting, that would give, and saying how awful it was, that would actually encourage soldiers to defect as they see how many others were doing it. So he's trying to, like, in the complaints that he has about how corrupt Nazis are, the actual aim was to make people less afraid of the Nazis and get them to start acting in their own self-interest. You know, in a sort of psychological way, what he was doing was, and he describes it so well himself, I hate to misquote him, spreading over the Nazis a layer of filth as thick as they put over the Jews. So he's sort of taking the hatred and anger of Nazi propaganda and turning it on the Nazis. And his aim was to exaggerated it ever so slightly so that it was pushed, what he called, into the ridiculous. He doesn't mean satire, because people were actually meant to believe the chef was the chef. And satire doesn't always work as a way to undermine propaganda. Satire makes the opposition feel good, but if people are already in love with the propaganda, it won't necessarily make them less so. He's doing something much more subtle. He wants to slightly exaggerate it and push it to an absurdity so that people become sort of more aware of its constructed nature. You know, when you slightly magnify something and distort it and make people go, oh, hold on, this is, you know, this is the original premise of this is kind of weird as well. So you think something quite subtle, but at the end of the day, Der Chef is all about, you know, breaking through taboos and saying the unsayable. But Der Chef is busted quite fast. I mean, even though he's the most famous of Delma's creations, I think by the end of 41, the start of 42, so like barely 6 months, the Nazis managed to work out that it's the British behind it and start publishing articles saying, this is actually the British. Deshev's popularity starts to fall quite quickly. People get kind of bored of the novelty of it. So even though it's his most famous creation, it's actually a story of unsuccess as much as success. And what Delmer goes on to do afterwards, having learned some lessons from that, was actually much, much more significant.
And if you want to hear about that, you're going to have to buy the book and read it yourself, okay, because we're out of time. So I've been talking to Peter Pomerantsev. We've been talking about his new book, How to Win an Information War, The Propagandist Who Outwitted Hitler, which is out now in the UK from Faber. Peter, thank you so much for taking the time to tell me about it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented, and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.